Rosenberg.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice.
It's hard to get back in the seat after listening to Peter Tosh, Equal Rights and Justice. Well, don't. Hey, we can move around and listen at the same time because this is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize because another world is possible. And we can make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, Harriet Washington, author of The Explosive Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present, pens another blockbuster, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. We'll talk with the author about this powerful and indispensable book on the devastating consequences of environmental racism and what we can do to remedy its toxic effects on marginalized communities. On Friday, thousands of students, hopefully hundreds of thousands, will take to the street for a massive demonstration to confront the climate crisis. Young people are striking from school, leading the way for the rest of us to make bolder demands and make more ambitious action. And I'll be on the streets marching with them, and I hope to see you there. Now, Brett Story and Seth Prince insist that to save the planet, a Green New Deal has to transform our entire society. And part of that transformation must include the deconstruction of our system of mass incarceration. Brett Story is professor at Ryerson University and a documentary filmmaker whose work focuses on the carceral geographies. She's the director of the film The Prison in 12 Landscapes and the author of Prison Land, Mapping Carceral Power Across Neoliberal America. Seth Prince is professor of epidemiology and sociomedical sciences at Columbia University, who focuses on the collateral consequences of mass incarceration for public health and how the division and structure of labor influence depression, anxiety, and substance use. And it is a great pleasure to have both of you as we celebrate the issues for climate justice. And Brett, Seth, thank you again for joining us and elaborate on your basic premise that to save the planet, a Green New Deal has to fundamentally encompass, shall we say, prison abolition, and expound upon that conjuncture between decarceration and climate justice that both of you have written so eloquently about.
Hi, Mimi. It's so great to be here and speaking to you today. Thanks for inviting us. This is a very exciting moment. It's also a devastating moment for many of us. We feel like the news keeps coming in almost every day about, you know, the state of our planet, and it can really to take that information in. But it's also extremely exciting, as you said, to see the students mobilize, see people finally talking ambitiously about ways in which we can make major transformations, not just in the United States, but all over the world, that that are practical, that are doable, and that can actually do great work to rectify the ecological consequences of so many decades of extraction and exploitation. So the basic premise of our article is that we can do this kind of work, this transformative work, to correct and assuage some of the worst effects of climate change, while all being people focused. And by being people focused, we mean, you know, offering a job strategy and healthcare and housing for actually also abates the crisis of mass incarceration in this country. Mass incarceration is own form of crisis abatement. It's a way of solving problems that are not being solved in healthier ways. It's a way of solving a problem of growing inequality. It's a way of not dealing with ongoing racism and actually furthering racism. It's a way of offering disinvested communities so-called job creation strategies and development strategies. And our basic argument in this article is that the same forces that crises that leads to mass incarceration are also the forces that have and profit accumulation over the environment and over ecological well-being, and that we can address and correct these problems and these crises in ways that make for a healthier society and don't cause us to lock people up, but in fact build infrastructure that will help people flourish.
Seth?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having us. I think the Green New Deal the idea of the Green New Deal has made it okay to talk about the fact that we can't really avoid climate catastrophe without fundamentally transforming our economy and our society. And it's really brought that idea into the mainstream. And prison abolitionists have been saying virtually the same thing for decades about ending mass incarceration and mass criminalization. So, you know, it's not just about closing prisons and calling it a day. It's about changing the conditions that gave rise to prisons as our preferred solution to social problems, as Brett was saying. And so, you know, the roots of these problems are similar, and it's four decades of neoliberal governance, deregulation, economic austerity, chronic disinvestment in low-income communities and communities of color. And it's not a coincidence that those are the same problems that are driving climate change. And many of the solutions to those problems that have been proposed in different Green New Deal plans are precisely the same policies that could dramatically reduce incarceration rates and even lead to abolition. So things like a jobs guarantee, housing guarantee, universal health care, reinvesting in education, empowering communities to care for themselves. These are all sort of basic baseline things that we need to do to confront the challenges that we're going to face.
I want to drill down even deeper. Let's continue this probe of we're almost suggesting politely, but that the climate justice movement or the climate change movement, maybe that's the problem, that it's a climate change movement more than a climate justice movement, but it would seem to be somewhat narrow. It focuses on the critical essential issues of the climate heat rising from carbon emissions and the like, but doesn't seem to encompass greater issues that most essentially affect poor communities, communities of color. So continue this push to perhaps move us from a siloized understanding of climate issues to a more comprehensive and holistic issue of environmental change, environmental saving, environmental racism as an essential part of this dialogue that we must be having?
I think you're absolutely right. And I just also say that I think often conversations about criminal justice are often treated in a kind of silo and in a very narrowly addressed, you know, imagined as if the only solutions for our problem of mass incarceration being a country that locks up more human beings per capita than any other place or time in history is one that could be addressed with modifications to sentencing. And really, we won't get very far if we continue to treat these issues in such narrow terms. And that is what's really important about this moment in which, you know, proponents of the Green New Deal are saying, no, you don't have to choose between saving the planet 100 years from now and paying your bills a month from now. It's not a zero-sum game, that we can, the government has the capacity, our communities have the capacity to make transformations that actually have a way of paying your bills and living your healthier life day to day.
I just want to mention, by the way, Brett, you're getting nonstop kind of dead spots. I don't know if that's where you're physically situated or whether you're moving around, but let's see if we can try to make the connection a little bit better. And for a moment, Seth, in terms of if you could pick up on and continue to plow through that question with us.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think as Brett was saying, the environmental justice movement, I think, historically has been seen as sort of kind of a privileged white consumerist movement. But there have been sort of local community organizations and groups for decades, like We Act for Environmental Justice in Northern Manhattan, that have been connecting the dots between environmental injustices, climate change, and the ways in which poor working class communities of color are often targeted for sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, as like the dumping grounds of our environmental waste. And so it's no coincidence that, you know, some of the most polluting infrastructure in cities is located in those types of communities. And at the same time as, you know, poor urban communities are being saddled to bear a disproportionate burden of those harms. Poor rural communities are being asked to house, countless prisons and new prison infrastructure. I think in our article we were trying to kind of connect the dots that between these poor rural and poor urban communities that are really require the same sorts of investments and programs, and they're natural allies in both the fight for climate justice, but also for criminal justice.
And hopefully we've got the problem cleaned up with Brett's communication with us. Cell phones are not all that they portend to be yet in any event. But Brett, I do want to ferret out some of the examples, like recently in accord with your premises on the imperative of prison deconstruction. Take us to Eastern Kentucky, for example, where local activists really sought to stop construction of a federal prison, and how that ties in and intersects with ecological devastation. Evoke the alliances with the environmentalists. Tell us those stories.
I apologize.
Oh, don't apologize. We do not hold you entirely responsible for the technological slings and arrows of the cell phone companies.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think what's going on is really instructive. So, you know, Eastern Kentucky in particular, sort of the Appalachian part of that state, which is traditionally associated with, you know, over a century of coal mining and the decimation of the landscape through the coal economy, is also, people might not know, one of the places in the country that's seen the fastest construction over the past 20 years has been basically a boom in prison building that correlated to spikes in crime, and that's just absolutely not true. The imperatives that underwrite this prison construction have everything to do with local politicians, including Kentucky congressmen, offering these prisons as a new job strategy, basically for unemployed coal miners who are suffering the economic fallout of the decline of the coal industry. So you've got a region that's ecologically devastated by this mono economy, and then a population that's economically devastated by the decline of the coal economy, and they're being asked to rally around prison construction and the mass incarceration of people in their communities, their issues. And recently, there's been something like a 15-year effort to build a new federal penitentiary in a county called Letcher County. Hal Rogers has been one of its major champions. And just very recently, Trump's proposed 2020 budget rescinded the almost around $500 million previously approved for construction. This is a major win for activists who've been fighting on the ground against the construction of this new federal penitentiary. And these are activists that aren't just prison justice activists, but are also environmental activists who have pointed out to some of the ecological fallout of this proposed prison by local watersheds, affect nearby forest growth, but more broadly, suggest that there is a different future that's possible for this region, that this could be ground zero of a major investment in renewable energies, that people have the capacity, the land is available, that this could be a place in which we really see people and capital put to work for a future that doesn't rely on either, extracting coal from the deepest wells of the land or incarcerating human beings. That there's a different way in which we can ensure livelihood and an ecological future for this region. So I think it's really instructive to thinking about ways forward and new kinds of futures that are possible for the planet, really.
Seth Prinz, prison abolitionists like to say that their objective isn't so much the abolition of prisons as it is the abolition of a society that could have prisons. It is a movement against cages, if you will. So let's go with that and again tie that in to the issue of a Green New Deal that sees the abolishment of carbon pollution and the stabilization of the climate.
Sure, yeah. So, I think our article was trying to communicate that it's not just an analogy or a metaphor, but in fact, the very same policies that we need in order to transform our economy away from extraction of carbon are the very same policies that prison abolitionists have been arguing for decades in order to address the root causes of mass incarceration. And I think, what the Green New Deal idea has kind of provided the language for is that we need to move away from simply managing the consequences of extreme inequality, racism, disinvestment, austerity, which is essentially what our system of mass incarceration is doing, and move toward actually resolving those things and ending those things. And so we can tackle the climate, we can tackle inequality, we can tackle mass incarceration at the same time with many of the same policies as long as they're green. And so, jobs, housing, healthcare, these are programs that, we should do because they're the right thing to do, and we should have done them decades ago, but they will also go a long way toward eliminating poverty, health disparities, structural racism, and avoiding the worst of climate change if we want to live in a future where the rich and affluent are protected from the worst effects of climate change. We can continue to kind of make technical policy tweaks to existing systems. But if we want to really have a healthy, flourishing, prosperous future for everyone, we need to finally engage with some of these programs.
So how do we really redefine that public safety, if you will, to include social and economic stability and jobs, et cetera? You're dealing with a holistic approach here, and that seems to be imperative if we are really going to tackle a safe and healthy climate. Indeed, the persistence, the continuity, the very existence of the planet would, it seems to me, depend on this. So take us, Seth, and I am going to focus a little bit more on Seth just because of the problems, I'm sorry, Brett, that we are having with your cell phone. But that doesn't mean I don't want to include you in the discussion. We'll soldier through those technical problems. But Seth, start us off on that.
Sure. So I think a really great example is if we just look at housing. The Green New Deal has proposed a housing guarantee as a means not only to repair some of the damage from the carbon-intensive construction industry, but also to create new jobs, create green jobs, and to provide conditions for people to live safely and securely in a context of unstable climate, unstable weather. Prison abolitionists and public health advocates have been saying for decades that housing is also a basic human necessity for living a minimally ordinary life. And without housing, it's incredibly difficult to maintain a job, to access social services, to participate in civil society. And people returning to the community from prison face really numerous challenges that make it even more essential that they have stable housing. Folks returning to the community from prison have a higher risk of mental health problems, substance use problems, HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. And so expecting those folks to sort of succeed in the community without stable housing, it just doesn't work. And we know that supportive housing, which combines housing and treatment with other services, we know it costs less than prison, it's more effective at reducing reincarceration. And so as the Green New Deal starts to connect the dots between the housing justice movement and the environmental justice movement, we also need to make sure that public health and mental health and substance use advocates are also at the table, because they've been pushing for the same policies as well for years.
And, you know, Brett, you use the term eco-apartheid within the context of the article, which is a Green New Deal for decarceration. Capitalize on that. The issue, again, of what is trying to be accomplished here is that a Green New Deal, a way of sourcing out and resourcing our communities, must encompass a holistic approach. And it must encompass the idea of the counterproductive status quo of racist and militarist policing as part of what, again, you are calling a kind of eco-apartheid. Flesh that out for us.
Sure. I think we're living in a moment. I think we see it in some of what's coming out of the feeling. This sense that one of the ways that we can, as a society, respond to the planet being in crisis is to double down on a kind of zero-sum game mentality where there is only a certain amount of resources, they're diminishing, and we better delineate who deserves them and who doesn't. I think that's the kind of thinking that informs the militarization going on at the border, and it's also the kind of thinking that informs mass incarceration, this idea that we've decided that some citizens, some human beings don't deserve access to healthy and stable lives. And I think that there's a real of going further down that path, which, as we know, is also a racialized path. Where are prisons being built? They're being built in the same places that toxic waste dumps are being built. They're poor communities and communities of color. And that's what we mean by eco-apartheid. But there is another way forward. And that way forward demands that we remind ourselves that that we don't have to, we can live in an economy that's redistributive, that shares resources, in fact, that enables the state to, and empowers the state to take resources away from, say, policing and the military, which, you know, cost huge amounts of money, and reinvest those resources in the things that we've been talking about. Jobs, renewable energies. And that's a mode of rejecting this idea that we have to be pitted against each other as communities for scraps that have been allocated to us, and instead demand more and better used resources that will allow us to flourish. That's the opposite of an eco-apartheid.
And Seth, as we conclude this segment of the program, tell us about some of the efforts in, for example, Appalachia, where there is this incorporation, where there is this holistic approach to a constructive, healthy society that inherently does mean weeding out, as part of seeking climate justice, racism and militarism and a structure of that of mass criminalization and mass incarceration.
Sure, yeah, and just to piggyback on what Brett was saying, I think this idea of eco-apartheid is that there's sort of green affluence and protection from the worst consequences of climate change for the rich. And then for everyone else, it's sort of surveillance and control and violence. And, you know, a clear example of that is already happening when we saw the Trump administration refuse to evacuate the hurricane victims from the Bahamas. And if we can imagine that sort of thing, but just happening every day in all aspects of our lives, I think that's what we mean when we talk about eco-apartheid. And it's what will happen if we kind of continue down the same path. But I do think that, just to answer your question, that, you know, we need to build the natural alliances and facilitate the dialogue between the shared interests of folks living in urban centers and the folks out in rural areas that are being asked to house some of these large facilities. And like we saw in Appalachia, these groups really came together and used the environmental impact of this proposed prison as a rallying cry, and it was really the environmental arguments against this prison that I think were decisive in stalling the development and then eventually killing the development.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us, and Brett for soldiering through. We've already ordered you the new cell phone.
Thank you.
But which will be a cell phone that's part of the Green New Deal, for absolutely. And we have been talking about a Green New Deal for decarceration. And that's the name of the article that has been co-authored by Brett Story and Seth Prinz. I encourage people to go online and get that, read it, because we have to have a much more constructive, encompassing dialogue for a real full court press for climate justice against ecological and climate racism, and to save our planet. And we can only save our planet if we work for equal rights and justice and saving our society. And indeed, mass criminalization and mass incarceration, that exploits our fears in order to extract people from their socioeconomic systems, in the process destroying communities and the networks of care and support required to lead to productive and healthy lives. And yes, as Brett Story and Seth Prinz insist, we need a Green New Deal to save the planet. We need a Green New Deal for decarceration to support and nourish the stewards of this planet. That's us. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
They call it a pipeline, but those on the front lines know that black snake was sent for us to grow, to shed the skin our ancestors pray of wounds old and calloused, so that we may stay, so that we may unite, unity our tool. No weapons are found in this court of rule. Men becoming ki'ai, steadfast in their guard, protecting women's hearts as their song become roots, roots to cast out healing for all sentient beings, to honor sacred mother, heart forward we heal. The salmon will run, the mauna will breathe, the rivers will flow. The rainbow is here, and prophecy tells us all generations will hear.
Nations and our people that been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poison in the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We won.
One nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock, and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my native people, to all the original people, to all my indigenous people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Planet Earth, it's been spinning, we've been living and dying, but giving birth, the first of many nations, celebrating them days when all that got made came after what
God made.
These days, we cater to these internet memes, internet streams, it seems them streams aren't clean. We need the whole story seen, we're hassling before water has gasoline in it. Malcolm X moment, Martin Luther King with a dream and war boning. Wounded knee plus Alcatraz, doggone it. This is for the rock, with prayers we stand on it.
Oh yeah, we playing on it, the earth we camp on it. In a sweat lodge, singing our songs with grandfathers. Heat rocks all in the spot, we splash on them. With a beatbox from my boy, we jam on it. Said a prayer for the black snake killers. Train on the front lines, they are the realest. Stand for your people, stand for your family. Stand with Standing Rock, stand for humanity.
Hey. It takes a group of people who actually care about, you know, Mother Earth and life and water being sacred and the land being sacred, to say we stand up.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my tribal people, recognize yourself, keep your head up. To all my native people, to all the original people, to all my indigenous people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Mini Wachoni, water is life.
Mini Wachoni,
water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
I stand
with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
I stand with Standing Rock.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
Stand up.
I stand with Standing Rock. Stand up.
To all my native people,
woke up the giant, we won't go quiet.
To all my tribal people,
don't mistake our peace as we stand and fight.
To all my native people,
it's the calm before the storm and I can hear it coming.
To all my tribal people,
I'm ready for the battle when we ain't running.
Stand up, stand up, stand up, stand up. Stand up, stand up, stand up.
History is on a sad repeat. Is it liberty or we just acting free? As our land depletes from these hands of greed. See, fate is found, how we face the hounds. Take a vow for these sacred grounds. Make a sound that'll shake them out. Say aloud, what can save us now?
What can save us now?
Stand up.
You're listening to Equal Rights and Justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and we are a bit on the horns of a dilemma here. We're trying to reach Sister Harriet Washington, who is scheduled to be with us at this time to discuss her book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. And what you were just listening to was a wonderful piece that I had the opportunity to record in Standing Rock during the struggle over the protection of our water system, the protection of the indigenous water system, and the struggle led by our sisters and brothers from the reservation to protect against the installation of a pipeline that would destroy the ecological system intact there. So what we may do as we continue to try to reach out to Sister Harriet, the theme there, as really the earlier theme of the program, is to understand in a much more cogent and impactful way the reality of environmental racism, which we seem to neglect as part of this broad climate struggle. So, for example, if you live in public housing and the housing is riddled with lead poisoning for young children, is that not part of the struggle for climate justice? How is it that we're bifurcating out those things? If you live in East Harlem, where there are bus transports, where there are endlessly idling buses, how does that affect and pollute the community? Is that not part of the struggle against climate injustice? We have to have a much more comprehensive look at things. Now, one of the stories I want to relate to you, because I'm about to open the phone lines in lieu of getting Harriet on and ask for your stories and your concerns if you are about to be part of that countdown to participate in, particularly tomorrow, the youth strike, but this entire global week for the future, for a climate strike, if you're a participant in that, and or if you have concerns about how we relate to and understand and organize around climate justice against environmental racism, I want you to think about calling us in, because you're about to become part of the program, and you can call 212-209-2877. That number would be 212-209-2877. We'll try to continue to get Harriet Washington on the line. Not like her to miss the contact, but as I said, we'll soldier through in her absence. But we're going to pick up the theme in any event. The communities that you live in, what are the contributions? What are the concerns? What are the issues that have to be raised about expanding our understanding about what the fight for climate justice is? And of course, we could go to Newark. We didn't have to go to Flint, Michigan to look at the water piping system and what the lead pipes and the lead in the water will mean for our youth, and particularly our youth who are overarchingly poor, our youth of color, and the like. So get on board with us. Kick in with your thoughts and concerns. 212-209-2877. And while we are waiting for you to join into this discussion about how to make the climate justice movement even more vital, even more cogent than it is now, I want you to get on board with us. So again, that number is 212-209-2877. And I know that we have a call on the line, whether it's Sister Harriet Washington, I'm afraid not, but you tell your story. Thank you. Where are you calling from, and your name, please?
Yes, I'm Zabby. I'm calling from Suffolk County, Long Island, and I'm calling from the working-class town, a white, mostly white, working-class town of Brookhaven Town, where they have a dump that is a huge problem, where we have a cancer alley of four different communities that for some reason they found that cancer is prevalent in this one geographic area. And also we had breast cancer on the north shore of the town as well, and all kinds of things. And I say that the corporations are the environmental terrorists. And I am so thankful for your program, Mimi, and many programs that you do, and this one especially, because indeed, climate, I don't go for this climate change thing. This is a diversion from the real issue of justice, justice, pollution of corporations, injustice, that in fact the corporations' injustice, and we've had from the oil companies, we've had the in different parts of Long Island, in Aquabog, the different runoff of the gas stations. It's unbelievable that corporations are getting away with the real. They are the real corporate. They are the real environmental terrorists who are terrorizing. And indeed, I'm so glad you're making this about justice. And I so loved hearing Seth Prinz speak, and also the woman is Brett, I'm not sure.
Brett Story. And I want to thank you for calling, Zabby. And I also want to add to this some of my own concerns. You're really firing me up. The polluted water, of course, in Flint, Michigan. Puerto Rico's slow recovery from Hurricane Maria. I mean, these are just a couple of examples of the ways that mostly poor people of color often suffer disproportionate harm from environmental crises. Now, how does the environment shape things like intelligence and IQ? I mean, these are some of the things we wanted to discuss with Harriet Washington in her book, which is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment, because what Washington has actually argued, for example, the whole concept of IQ, which is an absolutely flawed metric, is a useful tool to gauge cognitive damage brought on by environmental hazards. And when, we sit down and when we think about this, the negative effects of environmental racism can be seen in towns throughout. In Alabama, I was doing work, voter registration work, for example. In Utah, Alabama, very, very poor rural community. And I was thinking how bucolic, how magnificent, how beautiful it is. And was actually on my way to have a picnic in one of the areas during a respite from the voter registration work. And somebody says, well, no, you can't go to that area. And I said, why not? And they said, well, it's a toxic waste dump. It's indeed one of the largest toxic waste dumps in the world. Japan and all over brings their toxic waste there to this incredibly impoverished African-American community in the middle of what would seem to be this beautiful, a tranquil setting. So the issues of environmental racism are so cogent. And for, I think about the PCPs, how these things are affecting children. Again, the lead. Children are dying of diseases that we tend to ascribe to adults. Heart disease, kidney disease, and a lot of cancers, etc. And finally, when it was found that these people were dying from diseases that were caused by chemical companies, what happened with those chemical companies? Many of them just pulled out of the areas. They certainly never had to bear the brunt of the devastation that they had reaped on those communities. So I want to trigger more of you to call in and to tell us your stories and your concerns, because this is our fight and we have to broaden the discussion. 212-209-2877. You know, I was thinking of Johnny Cochran, who was a great lawyer, right? He had brought a number of lawsuits that would look at trying to get settlements to establish things like health centers and so on, based on these kind of disparate treatments and embedment of all kinds of toxicities, particularly in poor communities. So we have a caller on the line who's going to accept my challenge and become our program this morning. But after all, whose station? It's your station. So tell us who you are and where you're calling from and your contribution to this discussion on enhancing and broadening the climate justice struggle.
Yes. You're speaking with me?
I am indeed. Where are you calling from, brother?
New York City, so the Upper West Side. My name is Joshua, and I'd like to just make a comment about the what you spoke about and the caller just before. See, part of what the problem is, I believe, is how all these valid concerns become sort of in opposition to one another, and they're really all connected. There really is no solution to any of these unless they're all dealt with. And what I'd like to propose as a thought is, do you think, is there a creator, and does that one care about, I want to bring that into the conversation. Is there a creator, and does that one care about the suffering of mankind? Because I grew up, my parents were revolutionaries, and realizing the immensity of the problems and the many facets of all these problems, like the racism, and including what's happening to the earth and the environment, and all these things work with one another. Because the fact when there is, let's say, a drought, communities are ending up fighting each other over the water, over the grazing land. People are more easily exploited. War is...
Well, I think we get the gist of your question.
Right.
But one of the things that I want to posit, regardless of whether there's this kind of ontological argument about the creator or et cetera, the question, it seems to me, no matter what, and we want to move on to some of our other callers, and we thank you for calling as well, is the issue of we as instrumental to the issue in any event. We have to be the instrumentality, whether you believe in this greater being, etc., or some grand plan. Does not the question become, are we not the instrumentality in any event for the enhancement and the betterment of our communities? And what are the obligations of us to respond and, again, to broaden out the struggle and the understanding of what the ecological devastation and its effect on poor communities, working-class communities, communities of color are? We thank you for that. We want to get on our other boards. Our other listeners, our board is lighting up now. Obviously, we've triggered some thoughts. You're on the line, and where are you calling from?
Calling from the Bronx, Mimi.
Okay. So, cue us in.
Good to talk to you. Well, how is this all going to happen if I think consumerism, it's people who are buying the products that, I mean, there we go. It's like affect the dollar. You vote with your dollar, and that seems to make the biggest, you know, maybe consensus, and also the biggest bang for the buck. No pun intended. So I think as far as the weather goes and the climate, I think people are going to have to deal with it, and they need to make concessions. And at the same time, deal with the pollution aspect of it, because that's really what this is, for me, more about. The pollution is what's going to kill us. The climate, you just got to stay out of the way of it and you move.
Yeah, but why bifurcate it? Isn't the climate, the pollution, isn't it one and the same? I mean, think about this. You know, I do tenants' rights law. Among other forms of law. And but one of the things that I'm thinking about, there's virtually no child whose family I represent from public housing that doesn't, whether 6 months old, year, etc., who does not have asthma. Now, where does that come from? Is that not an environmental issue? We know that it comes from, it comes from, rat and mice feces. It comes from roach excrement and the like. It comes from the overall environment, which is a climate justice issue within our where we live. I mean, we used to have housing codes developed in order to prevent disease from spreading, etc. So I just think that part of this is not siphoning out, not just talking about the carbon issues and the heating of the planet, which is strategic, but it has to be talked about within the context of our rural and our urban areas and understood in a much more comprehensive way if we are really going to tackle these things. Which is why the issue we had on earlier with Seth Prinz and Brett Story also looked at the issue of decarceration, the definition of what climate justice, don't you think, has to be broadened out as well?
Well, my last comment, may I?
Please.
Okay. I'm sensitive and I'm looking over my shoulder and I look at this as a pyramid. And I'm on the bottom, you know, I'll just tell you, I'm on the bottom of this pyramid in life, economically and whatever. So not spiritually, not mentally, not emotionally, but materially and money-wise, I'm on the bottom. So I'm looking over my shoulder that everyone is speaking to the bottom of that pyramid to carry most of the weight. Now, what's funny, again, no pun intended, the bottom of something carries all the weight. But the real difference in this particular situation with the climate, I think, is going to be made to really speak to the people in the middle of the pyramid and up to the top. And let's see if the movements can get the bottom to move the top. I just don't see it happening. I think it needs to be more directed to the top.
Because I'm going to get one more call in before we move on. And I do want to tell people that even though she inadvertently stood us up this morning, Sister Harriet Washington, you can go and listen to her this evening at Revolution Books at 7 p.m. and tell her, where the heck were you this morning? And you can hear her talk about a terrible thing to waste, environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. And brother, my response to you is, you know, struggle is a long, hard thing, but nothing is more gratifying than the process of getting involved, collectivizing the action, and understanding that there is, we have nothing to lose, so to speak, but our chains and a world to win when we struggle. No demoralization is permitted over WBAI and amongst our listeners. And we've got our last caller. You're on the line. We've got the Bronx. We had Manhattan in the house. Where are you calling from? Oh, did we drop that too?
Hello?
Yes, we got you. Where are you calling from, brother?
You're not coming through very clearly.
Well,
can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. And we have just a matter of moments. You're on.
Yeah, you're not very clear. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, well, briefly, because I know you got to wrap up your show. Thank you very much for having the call in session that you can do. Briefly, it's a macro system. None of us are exempt from it. This is not an existential crisis. to the economics or anything. It is a part of our ecosystem. We are committing ecocide. It is not about just the children marching and leaving school tomorrow. It is about all adults, anybody that is concerned about the impending crisis that we're facing. And we need to recognize that we all need to do our part. Yes, we need to fight politically to deal with the broader issues of the manufacturers and all that. But each of us, each day, are part of a indoctrination into assumptions about ever expanding possibilities for production. Earth is going to get rid of this species called humankind and start anew. And we're facing it, and we now that comes to reality. What are we going to do about it? I think this is the problem, regardless of how we parse this in housing or racial identity or what have you. I understand all those nuances, but the macro issue is that we are a species about to become extinct. So all these arguments will be over very shortly, unfortunately.
Well, thank you. I do thank you for calling, but I refuse to end on that note. I'm going to be at Foley Square tomorrow and each and every one of the other climate justice activities that are taking place through September 23rd, because, as I said, we have nothing to lose but a chance, a world to win, and we're going to fight every inch of the way, because that's what we do on Equal Rights and Justice. Educate, agitate, and organize. And I still want to encourage people to go to listen to Harriet Washington this evening on environmental racism and the assault on America. You know, the Washington
everyone is crying out for
intelligence and inherited race. She identifies
none is crying out for justice
negatively on the effect of
everyone is crying out for
always a program about change.
None is crying out for justice.
You've been listening to this.
I don't want no peace.
All of
them. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. I need equal rights and justice. Got to get it. Equal rights.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Rebecca Miles, and I'll be hosting my first solo Midnight Ravers show on Friday, September the 20th, 2019, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. Join me as I present Tangled Up in Blues, where you'll hear many iconic blues women of yesteryear and today. So mark that date on your calendar, Friday, September 20th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., Tangled Up in Blues, only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, you know it'll be raver dynamic.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
So hello, this is John Kane from Let's Talk. With Indigenous Peoples Day still lingering in the shadows of Columbus Day, we have the perfect event to close out.